Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, Mark Tushnet in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Today is May 2nd, 2022, and we're doing a podcast about Mark's recent book about the court of Charles Evans Hughes. My name is Bill Domnarski. I write, or I should say I do podcasts about literary subjects and about legal subjects. So, Mark, let me draw you to the title page of your volume, which is Volume 11, The Hughes Court, From Progressivism to Pluralism, and it's all under the rubric of History of the Supreme Court of the United States, the Oliver Wendell Holmes Device. Now, that's some title page.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Tell us about the Oliver Holmes Wendell Device.
So Oliver Wendell Holmes was a great figure in U.S. constitutional and legal history. He lived to be 93. He had no children. He was married, but had no children. His probably shaping experience was during the Civil War, when he was on the battlefront and seriously wounded two or three times. Once, almost dying, the bullet grazed his neck and almost cut his, a serious blood vessel. And his view of the world was shaped by two things. One, a sort of fatalism about experience, but also a patriotism in preserving the Union. One of his most famous speeches was called A Soldier's Faith, and it's about fighting for a cause that you don't fully understand, but the fight is what matters. So as he was nearing death, he had a will that gave his entire estate to the government of the United States as an indication of his patriotic feelings. Congress actually didn't know what to do with the money for quite a while. It was there in the Treasury for maybe 13 years, something like that, after his death. And eventually Congress established a commission called the Wendell Holmes Device Committee to decide what to do about or with his estate. And the committee decided to commission a series of volumes on the history of the Supreme Court. And as you indicated, they've been coming out at irregular intervals. Mine is, what, the 12th, I think is what you said. The immediately preceding one in sort of historical sequence will be published next year or the year after. And then the series will be complete up until the appointment of Earl Warren. And there's now an Earl Warren volume in progress. So the commission's now out of money, basically. They've spent.
Who was writing the Earl Warren?
A history professor named Laura Kalman.
Oh, sure. I know Laura.
Yeah.
Oh, she's wonderful. I'm doing a podcast with her later in the year.
Right.
With her new book about, I think it's FDR. I think it is.
The court packing plan.
Oh, I didn't know she was doing that. That's great.
Yeah.
I mentioned that Holmes had written that essay about his Civil War experience. And the funny thing is, he's actually, I think, a better essayist than he is a judicial writer. He's a great judicial writer. Don't misunderstand me. But he's a terrific, terrific essayist.
Yeah. Two of his works, The Soldier's Face I mentioned, and a letter called The Path of the Law, are sort of classics that everybody, you know, who wants to know about the history of American law should read. I myself think an early article he wrote called Privilege, Malice, and Intent. It's an article about tort theory. It's an unbelievably brilliant piece of work, helps you understand lots of things about jurisprudence as it developed afterwards. So yeah, he was a very terse opinion writer. Partly that he disciplined himself to do that because he wrote physically in those days, of course, in longhand at a standing desk. So, you know, he would stand there at the desk and write out the opinion. And, when he got tired, he understood the longer it got, the more tired he'd get from standing around. So he figured out a way to condense things down. Some of his colleagues thought that some of his opinions were too brief, that they obscured difficulties that needed to be explored. I think Holmes's view was that he understood that the difficulties were there, but that the case could be resolved without discussing them.
I think in one of his letters, he famously said that when the knees begin to buckle, then it's time to stop, or something to that effect. Well, he, of course, appears in your book, but he doesn't make it all the way through.
No.
When does he leave the court?
He retires. These dates sort of blur because it's been a long time since I started working on the project. 1932 or 33, just before his, I think it's for his 90th birthday, he goes on a national broadcast to talk about, his life. You can actually locate. It's not the full radio recording, but the Harvard Law Library has available a portion of his sort of farewell address, and it's this frail old man's voice saying, his time has come, and so on. It's quite moving. I should say that one of the things that I learned in doing the book was that contrary to the, to supplement a view widely held in by legal historians and legal academics, that Holmes was a sort of austere, difficult, hard to get a handle on personality, his colleagues loved him. They called him charming. And he apparently was a great raconteur, even in his late 80s, early 90s. And they just enjoyed being in his presence. As he got older, he would fall asleep during the conferences, the court's work, and so on. And they, they understood that. But they really appreciated him as a person.
There's that great story that his housekeeper told about when Charles Evans Hughes came over to tell him it was time to retire, that he walked up the stairs. I guess his study was on the second floor. And she talks about Hughes going into the room and then coming out, say, 15, 20 minutes later, with tears streaming down his cheeks, because he had to tell the great man that it was time to go.
Yeah, yeah.
That says a lot about him, I think.
Right, right.
He's also a great letter writer. I mean, I can understand the charming part and being a great raconteur, because his letters are wonderful.
He had a wide correspondence. I think he was a very complicated personality. He did sort of need to be loved. And as time went on, you know, the sources of admiration changed.
Mm-hmm. All right, but let me get back to the Holmes device. How is it that you ended up writing this volume? Did you get a call in the middle of the night saying, help us, help us? What happens?
Yeah, so basically what had happened was that the first, when the commission decided to do this, they appointed Paul Freund, a Harvard law professor, as the general editor. Now, Freund had been a young law student in the early 1930s and had been in the Solicitor General's office during the New Deal, and then became probably the sort of leading constitutional law professor in the country after he went to Harvard to teach. And Freund decided to assign, or technically have the committee assign him responsibility for the Hughes Court volume. But he actually had difficulty in writing. I have to say, I took a course from Freund in my freshman year at Harvard as an undergraduate, and the course was the reason I went to law school. It was a brilliant mm-hmm. course. He was a great teacher. Or at least, you know, that course was a great course. It was just, it was wonderful. But here, Freund was never a productive writer. And I think he just had difficulty taking on large scale projects like this. And so either while he was still alive or just after he passed away, the committee chose another person who had written a dissertation about the Hughes Court, who was a law professor at the University of Michigan. And he worked on it for a while, produced a couple of large, important articles, but was also committed to doing other legal projects.
And now, who would that be?
A guy named Richard Friedman,
right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And eventually the committee decided that he was not making progress fast enough. And so in, I think it was 2008, 2007, something like that, they came to me to see if I wanted to take over the project. And I thought about it briefly, but I thought it was an interesting project to do. I knew it was going to take a long time. I sort of told my wife, actually, that the assignment was something like, you know, the black spot in Treasure Island. If it was passed on to you, you knew you were going to die. So I managed to get through it, but it took me more than a decade.
Just a word about Paul Freund. You say, I didn't know that he had trouble writing, that it took him a while, I guess, but he was a beautiful writer. His stuff really holds up well when you read it now.
Yeah, yeah.
So how would he have approached the project if he had actually had the time and the inclination to really pursue it?
So,
the reason I ask that is I'm trying to isolate the dynamics, I guess you would say, of your book, the things that you coalesce your themes around.
Right. So I'll just restate what you read. The subtitle of my book is From Progressivism to Pluralism. And the major theme is that during the Hughes Court years, I'd say all of the justices, including those who are now regarded as the most reactionary, actually had bought into a fair amount of the progressive restructuring of constitutional government. They disagreed about how far that restructuring should go. But they were all sort of progressives. And then by the end of the decade, Hughes served from 1930 to 1941. By the time he left, a new kind of political formation, interest group pluralism, was at least on the horizon. And you could see that in the court's work. So the theme of the book is, again, from progressivism to this new political formation.
You say in the book, when the opening paragraph, you say there was no constitutional revolution of 1937. Can you explain a little more about that and how that fits with the theme that you're outlining?
Yeah, so most of, I think the most common view of the Hughes Court is that it's divided into two periods, one up to 1937, when conservatives slash reactionaries were in control and eventually confronted the New Deal. Then there's this sort of 1 year period of a battle between FDR and the court, which in a complicated way, FDR basically won, although he was not able to enact his court packing plan, but he, the story goes, gained control of the court. And so, 1930 to 1936, conservatives in control, battle over the court, 1937 to 1941, the liberals get control. I think that's the conventional view. My take is that there were differences between what court was doing in the early 1930s and what it was doing in the late 1930s, no question about that. But the changes were not revolutionary or the direct product of the court packing plan and Roosevelt's simultaneous failure and victory. They were the product of a more sort of, I would say, evolutionary transformation within accepted premises of the law, where, again, justices who agreed on the same premises could come to different conclusions on specific cases. And when Roosevelt got new appointees, the new appointees came to a different set of conclusions, but they were not yet using a different way of thinking about the law.
So a lot of this turns on this well-known phrase, the switch in time that saved nine, or I think some formulation of that. So the prevailing view had been for many years that the pressure had been on the court to get with it, so to speak, to follow public opinion, follow the president. And suddenly there was a switch. But you don't think there was suddenly a switch?
Well, the story is quite complicated. On the one hand, the conventional story is that the two key justices, Owen Roberts and Charles Evan Hughes, were alert to the pressure on the court. And although they had been voting in a conservative way, as the pressure on the court built, they changed their votes to vote in a liberal way. Now, there are a lot of details to go into that to understand the story. I actually have an appendix to the book that tries to talk a bit about it. I don't use this line, but in Joseph Heller, the novelist, wrote a book called Something Happened. Mm-hmm. And it is clear that something happened in the period of the court packing plan. Something happened on the court. Exactly what happened is quite unclear. There's this wonderful statistical study that shows that charts the conservatism of Hughes and Roberts over a 5 or 7 year period. And the chart, which I find quite persuasive, shows a dramatic drop in Roberts's conservatism in the 1937-38 term, and then a rise. It goes back to being conservative. And it shows a similar, though not as dramatic, drop and rise for Hughes as well. So there's something going on. It's not persuasive to me that either Hughes or Roberts was directly responding to political pressure. They probably were sensitive to the fact that in the background there was this political stuff going on. There's a wonderful episode. When it occurred has become controversial, but I think the best view is sort of as the threats of the court were coming on, Hughes spent an unusually long time in a conversation with Roberts and at Roberts's farm, and probably did say something about, you know, what's going on politically. Roberts is a biographer of Harlan Fiske Stone, who was also on the Court at the time, interviewed Roberts about what had happened during this period. And Roberts is very, very, I think, sort of charming in this interview. And he says, you know, I don't really remember exactly what happened. And it's hard for me to explain why I seem to have changed my mind. But Hughes was a really persuasive guy. And I went along with him. Roberts has this, this is also complicated. Felix Frankfurter reports that Roberts says something like, who am I to condemn the good Lord for not making me as great a judge as Holmes and Hughes and Brandeis and a bunch of others. So he was, he appreciated his own limitations and understood that Hughes was a better lawyer than he was. And so, you know, Hughes could have been talking to him about legal, you know, how to think about these things legally. So again, something happened, not persuasive that it was, they started saying, oh, we have to worry about what Congress is going to do to us. Maybe thinking about, you know, what the court was going to look like over the next 5 to 10 years and how they would be remembered as judges, as members of the court. We will never really know for sure.
Now, Hughes was a dominating figure, intimidating figure. Someone described him as looking like Jehovah himself,
right,
with that great beard that he had. Did he ever, leading up to this, confront the reactionaries, McReynolds and his cohorts, about holding the legislation back that was going to affect the lives of millions and millions of people, the New Deal legislation that had been passed?
I found no evidence of that. He was intimidating as a legal mind, and he would, you know, make his legal arguments.
We need to, I think, during the first half of this period, you mark it to 37. It was a pretty divided court. I mean, this core group, the so-called Four Horsemen, were at least reactionary, maybe even more. And there was great personal animosity on the court, wasn't there?
Well, so again, I hate to say this. Again, it's a complicated story. So James McReynolds was a terrible person. And nobody except apparently Bill Douglas eventually liked him. They just couldn't get along with him. There's one episode where the courts divided over a case at the end of the term. He's gone off to a vacation. There are 9 justices on the court. He's gone off to a vacation. He voted one way before he left. And then coalitions changed, and it turned out that on one issue he had voted on, the court changed its view, but the majority shifted. He was gone. They didn't want to, going to be a pain in the neck to contact him. And so there was this opinion that says on this issue, the 9-member court affirms the lower court by an evenly divided vote. There's a note by a Harvard, Yale law professor called Sawing a Justice in Half. How does a 9-justice court divide evenly? It was because McReynolds had gone and they just didn't want to hassle with him to figure out what to do. So he was a terrible person. Everybody else was got along quite well. Everybody is a little overstated. But Willis Van Devanter, who turned out to be one of my favorite characters, very obscure justice. Everybody liked Van Devanter. He was just a nice guy. And George Sutherland was a very smart conservative lawyer who, again, you know, got along well with people. The one sort of exception, and this is a little tricky, is the justice I mentioned earlier, Harlan Fisk Stone, who was a sort of, I don't know, not quite prickly personality, but he loved to gossip about the justices. And one of his correspondents was Felix Frankfurter, eventually a colleague. And the two of them, and Frankfurter was a great gossip also, and the two of them sort of, I think, sort of fed their own worst tendencies, each other's worst tendencies. So when Stone wrote about his colleagues to Frankfurter, he was sort of, we would call it these days, snarky about them. And Frankfurter would reinforce that by saying, yes, how terrible the opinions were. But other than that, I think they got along pretty well. It's also, I want to note that while it's true that there were sort of divisions in the early period, there were also continuities that are worth emphasizing. So Sutherland, one of the great conservatives of the court, he was a terrific lawyer. He was been a senator and president of the American Bar Association. He was a really good lawyer. During this period, there was a case called the Scottsboro case, which involved the conviction of 8 or 9 African Americans for rape in Alabama. And these were what were then and now still called legal lynchings. They didn't really get a fair trial. So they appealed to the Supreme Court, and Sutherland writes just a brilliant opinion, holding that the defendants had not received their constitutionally guaranteed right to adequate assistance of counsel. And similarly, there are early in the period cases of striking down convictions of communist organizers for various reasons. In 33, the court rules in favor of New Deal legislation in 3 significant cases, with Roberts and Hughes in the majority. And so the opinions, the sort of op-eds afterwards say, oh, look, it's not going to be so bad with respect to the entire New Deal program. And then, you know, the program gets enacted and Hughes and Roberts see it somewhat differently from the way they saw the earlier cases.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
What's interesting to me, in a way, is you had mentioned that, who was it, had been a senator, Sutherland?
Sutherland.
McReynolds himself had been in government. He had been attorney general, if I remember right. Charles Evans Hughes had run for president. I think he's the only one who ever served on the court twice.
Right.
Is that right? Yeah. So you have this lineup through most of the 30s that's very, very different from the lineup that we have on the court today, where they are all, I think, except for your former colleague, Justice Kagan, circuit judges. Right. All of them have been circuit judges. The life experience that the other, that these Hughes court members brought, strikingly different from what we have today. Right. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. I mean, Hughes, not only, even before he was appointed to the court, he was governor of New York and was appointed to the court while he was governor of New York. And then while he was on the court, well, not technically, he resigned to run for president in 1916, and then was, you know, he lost narrowly, and then was reappointed in 1930 as Chief Justice. Even Stone had been a attorney general, a law school dean, and attorney general. But sort of even Willis Van Devanter, who was appointed to the court from a court of appeals, had been extremely active in Wyoming Republican politics. And he actually remained active behind the scenes politically in the 1920s and 30s. The people he knew gradually lost power. He didn't quite appreciate that. So he was sort of trying to help friends get judgeships by contacting his old political allies. Never was terribly successful, but he was enmeshed, even while on the court, in some aspects of politics.
And then when Roosevelt had his chance, I think he had 8 or 9 of them, to put people on the court, he too went with people with broad experience, like Hugo Black, senator from Alabama. Douglas had been, was the SEC commissioner.
Right.
Frankfurter is an exception. He was an academic.
He was a sort of leading public intellectual in the law. He wrote, again, what we would now call op-eds starting in the 1920s.
Wasn't he on the original masthead of the New Republic?
Yes,
I think he was. Yes. So that continued with Roosevelt's appointments. And again, that contrast is really striking with the appointments that we have today, which is another way of asking, what would happen today if we had a court made up of justices with this kind of deep experience in public life?
Well, there are some things I think that would be different. I think it's complicated because you have to think about who you would draw from what you're calling public life to be on the court these days, and with a polarized political system, you'd probably get people with deep ideological commitments, so let me back up. I think what you got from people like those who Roosevelt and Truman and Eisenhower appointed were people who thought that it was important to bring to deciding constitutional cases an understanding of two things. First, how government actually operated in the trenches, and second, how government actually affected the lives of individual people. That made them more, I would say, pragmatic, flexible, less dogmatic than they otherwise would have been. Not that they were non-ideological. Yeah, Hugo Black was quite rigid on some issues. But I think if you look for, you think about, suppose you told a president today, Democrat or Republican, that you have to choose somebody who has had significant experience in a non-judicial role in high, you know, national politics. And then think about who they would choose and who their parties would induce them to choose. And I think the answer is they would probably choose people who would think that, you know, their experience in politics was not something they should bring to bear on their decision making. So, at one point I suggested that Trump might appoint Mike Lee or John Cornyn to the Supreme Court. But we sort of know now how they likely would have decided cases.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably not that much different from the way Neil Gorsuch or Brett Kavanaugh decide cases.
All right, so all this, we're a little off topic here, but all this changes in the 70s when we begin the string of appointments to the high court who have circuit court experience. I'm going to put you on the spot. Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, my own view is that it's a bad thing, that we've lost a lot in not having judges with significant experience in national politics on the Supreme Court. I think it's the case that, could be wrong about this, but Sandra Day O'Connor was the last judge on the court who ever had to ask anybody, any ordinary person, for a vote. Mm-hmm. She was elected to the Arizona, I think, appeals court. She may have been appointed to the Arizona Supreme Court. But none of these people have ever actually had to say to ordinary voters, here's what I think about how government should behave in a way that will benefit you. I think that's a real loss.
It strikes me that it encourages a kind of arrogance that in a way is hard to fathom. It's so deep. The idea that people without a whole lot of experience are deciding which way we're going to go as a country strikes me as just terribly arrogant. But that's my own hobby horse, I guess you'd say. So let's talk about those personalities on the Hughes Court. We've talked a little bit about Holmes, and he's replaced by, I've forgotten now.
Yeah, Cardozo, I think.
Right. It's Cardozo that McReynolds has the feud with, because McReynolds is an anti-Semite, and he won't even be in the same room with with Brandeis. An extraordinary thing. Now, this is a time when they're not actually working together physically because they're all working from home.
Right. So the court building opens in 1935, and gradually until then they've all been working in their homes or in the apartments they have, and they'd occasionally visit each other and to talk about cases and so on, but they weren't in any central place. And then the building opens. Most of them don't really like the building. It was sort of William Howard Taft's project, and they, you know, it's too austere, it's too magnificent for them. But gradually they move in, and as retirements occur, instead of working from the house or the apartment, they move into the court. And then they start interacting with each other in a different kind of way. But you are, you know, you're able to, when you're working in your house or apartment, you don't have to deal with these your colleagues in a regular daily basis. You see them during arguments and during the conference, and then, you know, maybe you'll stop by to chat. Some of them live within blocks of each other, and some will actually walk to the court together. Different work experience.
McReynolds had a law clerk who then wrote a diary, I guess you would call it, and he later published it. And it depicts him in this working environment that you're talking about. And it paints him as being, I think, extraordinarily aloof from the court.
Yeah. It's not unusual, I think. If you think about sharing workspaces, or maybe think about what the experience of working over the past 2 years has been, it's a different experience when you don't see your colleagues on a regular basis, physically. Physically, you know, we're not physically in the presence of your colleagues. It's just different. And they had developed working styles based on the fact that they were working at home. Again, occasionally socializing, but not, it's not like, I was a law clerk in 1972 and 73, and I have this vivid memory of, it could be false, but it's clear in my head, seeing Justice Brennan, who was a sort of shortish guy, and Justice Powell walking down the halls together with Brennan's arm draped over Powell's shoulder. Now, that wouldn't happen if they were not working in the same building. And, you know, Brennan had a way of dealing with people that worked differently in person than remotely, as we would now say.
Was he the most important justice on that Warren court? The court that Hugo Black at one point said should be known as the Black Court.
Right. So I've written a bit about this. There, Brennan and Warren were sort of co-generals. I don't know if that's a thing, but they each had different kinds of strengths that that reinforced each other. And I think, you know, not just because of a change in personality, but Brennan had to operate differently after Warren left the court than he had been with Warren on the court. He did. He was quite successful on the court. So, you know, we think of the Warren court as during Warren's chief justiceship from 1954 to 1968, I guess it is, 69. I actually think the Warren court is sort of the Warren Brennan court from 1962 to 1976 or 77. So it continued after Warren had left, and partly because of Brennan's continuing effectiveness.
Well, I was going to say that in your case here with the Hughes court, it fits pretty nicely, a transformative period. But a lot of times calling a court after the Chief Justice doesn't really reflect what was going on as to who the dominating personalities were, the dominant influencers on the court. And I think the Warren court that you're just describing is a very good example of that. In fact, people say today that it's not the Roberts court, it's the Thomas court. I saw an article just a few weeks ago about that. Yeah. I don't know how true that is, but that's what some people think.
Yeah, it's, you know, it is misleading to label, to periodize the court according to the Chief Justices. As you say, as it happens, the Hughes court is actually not a bad periodization. Probably better to start it, to actually start it with Hughes, but end it probably, I'd say, with Stone was his successor. Probably the relevant period should be 1931 to 1945 or 46, when Stone passes away.
And Fred Vinson, of all people, becomes Chief Justice.
Yeah, right.
I've had this great fortune in getting people like you. I had Mel Yourofsky on a podcast about his book on dissents and how important they've been in American history. And I wanted to actually just take advantage of the fact that I have people like you that I can ask these questions. Are you optimistic about the Supreme Court these days, or are you, like me, in a world of dread, knowing that soon everything's going to change?
So I have to say, I have no good expectations from the court as currently composed. Okay, I've been for actually quite a long time a proponent of what's called either court packing or court expansion, which I think is more. We could have seen the necessity for it a while ago. It's become, in my view, more urgent now. It's, of course, completely unlikely to occur in the short run. But one way of describing what happened in the 1930s was that for mostly accidental reasons, the court got too far out of line from where the general population was. It's always going to be a bit out of line for a variety of structural reasons. But when it gets too far out of line, political, judicial, constitutional crises, conflicts are likely to arise. Sometimes those conflicts are productive. I'm not against conflict as such. But I think we may be on the way to seeing something like that happening over the next 4 or 5 years. And then it'll be interesting to see how it's resolved. I mean, I'm getting old, so it's not going to affect me directly, but there may be, although I don't have high and very low expectations from the court as currently composed, I'm actually more open to the possibility that there'll be valuable developments from my point of view, again, if you take a 5-year perspective.
Well, I wish I could share your, or at least moderate optimism, because I think we have cultural warriors on the bench now, beginning with Thomas and going to the most recent appointments. And I don't think they're ever going to budge and take stock of public opinion and how the public wants certain constitutional rights, even though they're not explicitly recited in the Constitution. So you said that you got this appointment or assignment back in 2008, I think it was, to write the book. And it comes out in 2021. That's a long gestation period. It must have been a difficult book to write.
Difficult to write is probably not the way I would describe it. There was a lot. I had to learn an enormous amount of stuff to do it. It was tremendously valuable. I learned a lot while I was doing this. And I should say, I couldn't have done anything like an acceptable job earlier in my career. I just had to have a lot of, you know, background stuff in my head to do it. And it did take a lot of research and effort to figure things out. Once I'd figured out themes for the various sections, the actual writing was not as difficult, but it's a very long book. Mm-hmm. So to say, you know, I could write a chapter in 2 months says, you know, that's what, there's like 24 or 30 chapters. I don't know, but that's, you know, 2 or 3 years of writing. Just doing the writing after all the research is done. It wasn't hard to write in the sense of, you know, producing this stuff, it took a lot of effort to get in the position of being able to write the story I wanted to write. That's what took the time.
Well, I'm holding it up now. It's unfortunate that the we just have an audio transmission going out to the audience, but it's a beautiful book. And it's not only a big book, it's a very heavy book. It must be the type of paper that was used. One of the things that I noticed in looking at the website for the Holmes device, it says that yours is the, or it is true of all the different volumes, the official version of events. How does that affect you as a writer, knowing that you have this obligation to be, what, impartial, neutral? What is it that leads to the official status that the book gets?
Oh, I have to say, I know, I wrote the book I wanted to write.
Okay.
I didn't, not, I mean, in some sense, it's an authorized court, history of the court, but it's not as if I had in mind, gee, you know, there's somebody out there who has to, in some sense, approve it. Technically, it did have to be approved by the committee, but I had, it didn't affect anything that I had.
So the committee never comes in and says, we want you to change your point of view on this, and this. Okay. All right. So this might be too difficult a question to answer, but if you were to, how many hours a week did you work on it, generally speaking, from 2008 to 2021?
I would guess it was somewhere, I have to back up by saying I understand that I am a workaholic. So hours per week is not the way I would measure things, because that would seem ridiculous to anybody else.
Okay.
I would say on average, between one third and one half of my time was spent on the project for the entire period. Now, sometimes I had leaves that I was doing research travel for, where I was doing it 100% of the time, but on average, probably between a third and a half overall.
Now, I would think that this is a career capping moment in your life with the publication of this book.
That's certainly how I think of it. Actually,
is it getting much attention?
I'm sorry?
Is it getting much attention, the book?
It's not, it just came out. It's huge. It takes time for people to appreciate it. So the answer is not yet, but we'll find out. We hope to do some large-ish event at Harvard in the fall that will make more of a splash than it has so far. But you know, this is a book to be on library shelves and to be consulted over the next decades rather than to get on the New York Times bestseller list.
Well, I am absolutely delighted that Cambridge sent me the book. It cost $265. It's a great addition to my library, and every library should have a copy of it. Do you have a sense of how the previous volumes have sold?
No, I don't actually. The only thing I know is, you know, the committee has run out of money, which means that they weren't getting enough royalties on the books to keep going. But other than that, no, I have no idea.
Now, remind me, what's the one that's in progress now?
The Taft Court, Robert Post of Yale, is just finishing that up.
Oh, he's just finishing it?
Yeah, I think
he listed it on the opposite the title page. They have all the volumes 1 through 12, and they have his listed.
Yeah,
is he? I think writing it with another fellow, Benjamin. He's writing it with somebody else, isn't he?
No, this is another one of these complicated stories. When he became dean at Yale, his work on the project flagged, and they thought he was going to add another author, and then he finished the deanship and decided to finish the book on his own. At least that's as I understand the stories.
John Fabian Witt,
right?
I think his name. I think he was working for at least for a while on the book with him.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not now,
but I think it's going to come out under Post's name solely, or maybe with, you know, not co-authored.
I've emailed with him over the years about different things, and he's a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
So it should be a good book. He's also a very talented writer, and I want to be sure I say this to you. You, too, are a very talented writer. I mean, I don't know if it comes easily to you or whether you're like Freund and had to struggle with it, but you're a great writer. You really are. You bring the whole thing to life.
Well, I appreciate the comment. It took me many years of writing badly before I started to write well.
So. Well, that's what law reviews will do to you. So, all right. Well, I think we're about done. Anything else you want to add about the book and the effort that you put into writing it?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered just about, maybe not everything, but, you know, I could go on for another 2 hours, and you don't want that. So.
Well, I do, but I'm not sure the audience does. So it's been great. As I said, I find it to be a real privilege to be able to talk to folks like you who have spent a lifetime really studying the law, studying history, and then you bring it to life in a book like this. It's just a wonderful thing to be able to partake in, so to speak. So